Moncrief on News Talk.
Now then, it is time for the Moncrief Murder Club. I'm happy to say we're joined by Cassie Delaney. To tell us more, Cassie, how are you today?
I'm good, yeah. I mean, melting like the rest of the country, I suppose.
Long may it continue.
That's it.
It's like living in LA or something. It's brilliant. So I love the introduction of this. It says, three cases where the weather was an accomplice, a witness, and in one case, the detective.
This is it. So I just thought, given the weather we've been having, I wanted to make the people aware that actually in heat waves, crime spikes massively because more people are outside. It's a dangerous but lovely time for all. But I found three murder cases where the weather has played a really crucial part in the story. So I'll jump straight into the first one. And this is where a case where the alibi is destroyed by a rain radar. So in case you didn't know, every bit of weather all the time is being tracked. You can assume that to be true. But it has undermined one particular murder case here.
But it's an archive, though, isn't it? People can recreate what the weather was 20 years ago.
Exactly, yeah. So
I don't know why I find that unsettling. I mean, I don't really have any secrets. I'm not going to lie to you now. I haven't killed anyone. But when I find this out, I feel like they're spying on me somehow.
Well, you just can't get away with anything, especially in this day and age. I always say about murder, it was a lot easier to do murder back in the day. But like now with the technology we have, it's incredibly difficult to get away with it. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about a profession that I'm sure you've probably never heard of. And that's a forensic meteorologist. And these are the scientists who reconstruct the weather for courts at a very precise day and time using archived radar, satellite imagery and weather station records. There's only a handful of them in the world, very, very niche specialist career. And they are brought in murder trials to testify, sometimes in bombings, insurance rows, skiing accidents, and in one case, a kitesurfing incident.
Wow.
It's interesting, yeah.
I'm always fascinated about how people get into those jobs. I don't know if you remember leaving school, the Department of Labour.
Yeah, definitely wasn't on the CAO farm.
I would have been interested. Yeah.
Of course. The premise of this field is quite simple, really. So the weather is always being recorded and the archive never forgets. And somewhere there's a record of exactly what the sky was doing on every single day of your life, which it is a little unsettling, but also kind of cool.
You have to say, you see more scope now. I mean, you could, for a birthday present for somebody, you know, collate what the weather was when they were born, what the weather was when they got married, what the weather was when all the kids were. It'd be a nice thing,
I'm a December baby, so I don't want to hear that it was pouring down rain outside and absolutely miserable. But we're in January in 2002 in upstate New York, and there's a young couple called Erica Schneider and Samuel Holly, and they are found brutally murdered in their apartment. It's an absolutely vicious scene. They've been stabbed with knives taken from their own kitchen. Definitely a kind of crime of passion here, I think, something that happened in the moment. And they've both been badly beaten. But the thing about this is they're two grown adults. So whoever did this would have had to have been pretty strong and pretty big to overpower two adults. And the examiner notes that between the two of them, there's very few defensive wounds, which tells the investigators that whoever did this was strong enough and fast enough to get the two of them.
Oh, scary.
Very, very scary. So the case goes nowhere for years. Investigators recover two pieces of physical evidence, a blood stain on a bedsheet belonging to someone unknown and a palm print in blood on the wall. But in 2002, there's no match for either of those blood stains in their database. And so the case goes on. In 2007, two men are actually indicted for the murders. These two men, as it turns out, had nothing to do with it. They were just sitting in the system, heading for trial, while the real killer was getting on.
I really wonder how those things happen. And they seem to happen in the States so often, don't they?
I think the desperation to pin a murder on someone and take them off the streets is so great that they kind of overlook some crucial evidence, or they explain it away sometimes. You know, we know that they have the kind of three M's for murder: motive, you know, opportunity, and means. So they, if they can find someone who meets enough criteria, I think they're willing to put them behind bars. I mean, we could do a whole other day on the wrongs of the judicial system, but we'll...
That's scary, though.
It is very scary. So it wasn't until 8 years after the murders in February 2010 that a routine database hit changed everything. A man named Michael Mosley had his DNA added to the New York State database for kind of another crime or something. And the matches there sparked up that it matched the blood on the bedsheet and the palm print on the wall. So police bring him in and ask him, is it your blood or, you know, were you responsible? Were you there? And he explains that in the evening before the bodies were found, he took his son snowboarding at a park in Troy where he fell and cut his rock in the hand. And he cut his hand on a rock. The next morning, he called around the apartment to give Holly a lift to work. The door was unlocked. He walked in. He found the two bodies, panicked and ran out. And that's kind of why his blood had ended up on the scene.
Right.
That he just hadn't raised alarm with investigators.
Ran in, pressed his bloody hand against a wall.
In shock, with your mouth and hands to the wall. So he said he'd then gone back to his mother's. And his mother backed him up, saying that he'd come home the evening with an injured hand. So he said after he'd gone snowboarding, he'd gone back to his mother's house. And his mother kind of backed up that story. She said she remembered it quite well because it was the night before her 50th birthday. And it was a good story. Like, it explained the blood, it explains the print, it involved his child as well, which adds a certain wholesome element to it.
Yeah.
Who would lie? Who would bring their child in as an alibi?
Though. Who doesn't just run straight to the police? Why do you walk into a scene and think,
there's plenty of cases
they'll think
like
I did this?
Yeah, there's some very, very famous cases, and maybe get into another week of celebrities who turned up. Ashton Kutcher famously turned up at a murder scene and called his lawyers before the police.
Wow.
Yeah, because he turned up as a woman who's dating, but I'll save that for another day.
Okay, I'll look forward to
that. I think the listeners are probably getting concerned about my encyclopedic knowledge, just murders off the top of my head.
Yeah, it's good. I'm impressed too.
But the weakness in this is that obviously snowboarding, very specific accident. Now, bearing in mind 8 years has passed, so he's kind of maybe scrambling to get an alibi together, get an excuse together, and the snowboarding detail is just very, very specific. So the prosecution could have just left it at that and brought in a, you know, kind of taken his word for it. But instead, they brought in the forensic weather experts who went back through the archived data for Troy, New York, on the 24th of January. And what it showed was very interesting. It was absolutely pouring rain that day. So there was no way that snowboarding could have taken place because the rain would have just completely melted the snow. So his alibi just fell to pieces and everything else then started to look differently. His uncle, who was his supervisor at work, admitted that he had come and he had missed work the week after the murders, and that when he did come back, one hand was really badly swollen and the other was cut and bruised, which is kind of inconsistent with the idea of just falling down and hitting a rock. And also an old coach testified that Mosley had been a championship wrestler. He was incredibly strong and very quick, which lined up to the suspects at the start that he could have gone in and very quickly overpowered them. So in 2011, he was convicted of both murders and sentenced to life without parole. The two men who had been wrongly indicted before got to walk free. Now, they had a couple of years of their life taken away for them. But yeah, it was just...
It's incredible.
A mad story.
Absolutely. Once you're caught out in a lie like that, though, it all starts to fall apart, doesn't it? You've lost all your credibility. Any bit of goodwill towards you is just over once you're caught
out
like that.
Completely. And it's such a small detail that you wouldn't think to question, saying I was snowboarding without really thinking about how quickly that could be unravelled and proven wrong.
What a thing to live with all that time. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. Your next one involves more snow. But a really strange character in this story, isn't there?
Super, super strange. This sometimes, you know, you hear those kind of tropes that murderers will often return to the scene of crime or become fixated on the crime itself. And this is certainly true for this guy. This is where snow has kind of been a crucial witness in a murder. And it's an interesting substance in a murder investigation because it does two things at once. It both hides and records. So it will compact a footprint, but maybe in this direct aftermath of a crime scene, it'll snow again and it can cover things up. But in this case, there was footprints left outside. So this is the story of a man who understood the property of snow so well that he made an attempt to erase it. He knew that it would take more than just freshly fallen snow to delete the evidence. And he actually went and purposely tried to remove it. We're in 1984 in Colorado, just 5 days before Christmas. And there's a young girl, Janelle Matthews, who's only 12 years old, unfortunately is the victim in this story. She'd spent the day performing with her school choir at a Christmas concert. And afterwards, a friend family dropped her back home around 8:30. His father is across town watching her sister play basketball. You know, that kind of Christmas rush.
Absolutely.
With loads of stuff going on. And her mother is away visiting family. So Janelle, at 12 years of age, lets herself in. But in the 80s, that's not that unusual. She's supposed to be home for just about an hour on her own. And when her dad gets back around 9:30, the front door is unlocked, the lights are on, Donnell's shoes are crucially by the heater, but the house is silent and she is gone. There's no note, no sign of forced entry and no struggle. It just seems like she's completely evaporated. But when the police arrived that night, first thing they do is look out the back, and in the snow behind the house, they find footprints. So someone had been watching out in the dark and watching Janelle at home on her own. So it captured this kind of, you know, the essence of this stalking. It was preserved pretty much like a photograph. But what it couldn't give them any more detail than just they knew somebody had stood outside, because the trail led nowhere. The case just simply stopped. They had these footprints outside the back window, but no direction and no pattern.
No sign of her.
No sign of her. So Janelle this is a huge case, a huge, huge story across America. She's one of the first kids to actually have their photograph printed on milk cartons.
And I saw them in America once. They're really disconcerting. They're
very
really
unnerving.
It was in Colorado, actually, and I saw them. And it's just what must be going through the family's minds, the heartbreak and the...
And reminded, you know, of it every day.
But pitching your best hope is that somebody will see, you know, a milk carton and think, hang on a second, it's scary.
Some of the things, even like the Amber Alert text messages that go out to everyone when a child has disappeared, it's just incredibly unnerving detail. I'm mad that there things that like that have developed so that we can hopefully catch people who prey on children. It's horrendous. But unfortunately, nothing comes of any of that searching or the milk cartons. And for 35 years, there's absolutely nothing on this case. It goes cold essentially until July 2019, when a crew are laying an oil pipe through farmland about 24 kilometres from where Janelle had been, and they find human remains. It was her. And in unfortunate detail, that she'd been shot in the head. So very gruesome, horrific death. Suddenly though, the police had a murder scene, and detectives were able to go back to the beginning and try and sit down with all the thousands. There was 28,000 pages of reports. I mean, that just goes to show how many witnesses or people they might have interviewed or tips they had coming in from those milk cartons. This was a huge, I mean, the president at the time, Reagan, was referencing this in his speeches. It was a huge, huge case. But buried in those decades of paperwork was one local man named Steve Pankey. He was a former neighbour of the Matthews family who had gone to move on to Idaho. He'd run for governor twice over there, so not laying low by any means. He had only appeared a kind of handful of times in the original files, but it was always by his own direction. So he hadn't necessarily been someone of interest to the police, but he kept ringing into the police line with tips.
Bizarre.
So drawing attention to himself. With his kind of thoughts and theories about the Janelle Matthews case. So he had no real official connection to it other than this kind of hyperfixation on it. But one of the details he offered up was that the kidnapper must have used a rake to cover over their footprints in the snow.
If I was a detective, I'd be saying, how would you know that? And
exactly. So the footprints were behind the house were only known to investigators. And then an idea that a rake had to have been used to end the trail or cover them up was a very specific detail and theory that likely only someone at the scene could have known. And he also mentioned in passing that he used to enjoy watching the local children walking up and to and from school, which is a very, I think, strange thing to say,
in
this kind of investigation in general, but a very strange thing to say in a child's murder inquiry. So detectives finally made contact with him after the remains were found, and he immediately asked for a lawyer, which is a big red flag. And his ex-wife testified that he had a lifelong obsession with the case. She remembered that in the days after Janelle vanished, when a preacher stood up and declared that the girl would come home safe, he turned around and whispered "false prophet" under his breath, with the kind
and
of
that
assurance
had stuck with her.
Yeah, because such an odd thing to make a statement like that with a real assurance, you know, to be really certain that something, that she's not going to come back. And this is in the early days of her disappearing, when everyone's holding on to hope. A really insensitive thing to say, a very definitive thing to say if you weren't like the rest of the people who didn't know where she was. So there was no actual physical evidence tying him to the crime. But after 35 years, with the body recovered from under a pipeline, there was hardly going to be any physical evidence. But in his first trial in 2021, it ended with a hung jury because of that lack of evidence. The state went again, and in October 2022, at his second trial, which is really, considering this was a murder in 1984,
yeah, it's a lot of time. A lot of suffering for that
mad
family.
Mad amount of suffering. And it brings it kind of relatively into the recent day that in 2022, at his second trial, he was convicted of the kidnapping and murder of Janelle Matthews and sentenced to life in prison.
Thank God for that.
Yeah, but very interesting. The thing that did him in was his own mouth and his own inability to stay quiet.
If he had said nothing.
If he'd stayed nothing and just been normal and not drawn attention to himself repeatedly, he would have gotten away with it.
Your next one involves a hurricane, which I suppose in the story of this is destroying evidence, but not enough evidence for the man involved.
Not enough evidence here, thanks to a very committed family. There was actually, for a side fact again for you to reveal my weird hyperfixations on weather-related murders, in Hurricane Katrina, there was over 21 murders committed as the hurricane took place, but most of them were solved.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it's a really common occurrence that when there's a bad weather incident that people, if you've got any gripes against people, they kind of act like the purge and go out and get them out of the system before the weather tends to cover up.
My God. Right. So this is a young woman on the 25th of August, 2017.
Yeah. So again, relatively recent. We're in Texas and you'll remember kind of Hurricane Harvey. It was a huge, huge storm. Just east of Houston. Crystal McDowell is 37. She's an estate agent and a mother of two young children. And by every account, a woman, by friends' testimonies, a lovely woman who had kind of built a very successful life for herself. She'd had a very sad childhood and come through it and built a career and family. But her and her husband, Stephen, were getting divorced. And it was one of those arrangements that everyone described as pretty okay, like amicable and fine. She was staying in his house with the kids while her own townhouse was renovated. So from the outside, it looked like they were good.
That strikes me as odd. I have to say, if I'd split up with somebody to be staying in their house with them after we'd split up.
I mean, there's kids involved here, so maybe they're at least trying to be well behaved in front of the children, it seems. So we're in the 25th of August, 2017, and at 7:30 that morning, security cameras catch Crystal leaving her boyfriend's house and getting into her Mercedes. She's on her way over to Stevens, who's the ex-husband, to collect the children, with whom she is staying, but she never arrives over into the house. And this is a crucial piece of context. At that moment, everyone else in the county is kind of shutting down, boarding up windows, because Hurricane Harvey is expected to make landfall that night. So this Harvey turns out to be one of the most destructive storms in American history. It stalls over the Houston area for days and drops over a meter of rain. So there's floods, neighborhoods are drowned, tens of thousands of people are displaced and emergency services are stretched beyond their limits. The news is just coverages wall to wall. And in all of that, in the chaos of all that, Crystal quietly seems to disappear. Her Mercedes turns up abandoned in the flooded car park of a Motel 6. And it slots perfectly into this sort of story that she's another...
got into trouble, abandoned the car.
A weather victim. Yeah. And you could hardly design better conditions because the flooding, just evidence is just washed away everywhere. And this is something that her ex-husband, Stephen, is pretty much counting on, that it won't be taken, it won't be looked at too closely given the chaos of everything else that's around. But her family would not let it rest and they did not for a second believe that she had been a victim of this weather. It wasn't Stephen, crucially, who reported her missing. It was her uncle, Jeff Walters, who had phoned in from a motel where he was sheltering from the hurricane with his elderly aunt. So Crystal was known for being regularly in touch with people. And when she did not answer her phone to the people who loved her, it was like an instant alarm bell going off. Even her long-term best friend woke up the morning of her disappearance, 1,500 miles away, feeling that something bad had happened to her and spent the day texting and trying to call to her. So she was prepared to get onto a
plane. You have the uncle and you have her best friend being worried, but the ex-husband doesn't lift the phone.
That's it. And she was going over to him and she never arrives. He should be the first person. The boyfriend that she had left also didn't report her missing, which meant...
very odd.
Yeah, very odd. The hurricane wasn't enough, though. The hurricane was holding back people trying to get to her. So this did slow things down for a while. But the day after she vanished... relatives managed to get to Stephen's house and confront him, and he claimed that she hadn't been home in over a week. His own small daughter quietly told the great uncle, though, that she'd hugged her mommy goodbye the day before, which undermined his story once again. A sheriff's deputy noticed Crystal's black dress sitting in the washing machine, so if she hadn't been there in a week, you put the wash on. And there was also this really big detail that made everyone very, very anxious here, and it was that Stephen had previously threatened a murder-suicide involving him and the children and the whole family. So he didn't seem like a very reliable, caring person.
Very stable, anyway.
Yeah. So the storm could, of course, hide the body. As I said, things were absolutely chaotic. But what it not could not do is go back and erase CCTV footage. And when the water went down, investigators pulled the CCTV footage, and there it was. It was Stephen parking Crystal's Mercedes at the Motel 6. And then in a detail that just made him look so dodgy, cameras at a nearby Walmart showed Stephen buying a bicycle, which he then used to cycle home from the spot where he'd dumped her car. So, you know, yeah, a getaway bicycle is a very interesting
transport.
But again, placing himself somewhere where he's buying things, presumably with a card, and he's able to, you know, he's placed near the scene. So investigators are really circling around Stephen kind of 2 weeks after Crystal has died. And Stephen cracks. He confessed to his own adult daughter from a previous marriage. She just straight up asked him if he knew where the body was. And he looked away and started sobbing. And then on the 9th of September, he started agreeing to negotiate with authorities. They took the death penalty off the table, and he led the police to a dense woodland near his house where he said that the murder had taken place and where Crystal was. He had strangled her from behind during an argument on the morning she came to collect the kids, wrapped her in a blanket, put her out there and driven to the woods as he braced for the storm, knowing that kind of the evidence might have been washed away. In his defense trial, he said that it was a spontaneous hug that had spiraled out of control into a strangulation. But the jury deliberated for 3.5 hours and convicted him of murder, giving him 50 years in prison.
I feel a little bit of an hooray coming on again there as well.
Well, the family weren't that happy with it. An uncle in court shouted out, "He deserves worse," from across
the court. Yeah, understandably. But I think when we're used to terms of 14 to 22 years and stuff, it seems like an age, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
God, and you'd such incredible stories. People are so strange, aren't they?
And you know what? We'll never run out because people keep doing strange things.
And let's hope it's not all weather related and that this continued good weather doesn't bring the worst out in us.
We'll wait and see.
We'll wait and see. Carson, thanks very much for that.
Thank you.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.